I think what I'm going to be giving you is a, it's an anthropological, ethnographic kind of account, but it's almost kind of a post hoc account from having done the work from the inside from a different position as a qualitative health researcher, whatever that means. We'll talk about that. So I'm going to be talking about the development of a new set of WHO guidelines involving task shifting for maternal and child health. In task shifting, it's shifting between different cadres of health worker. In this particular case, you can see the list there of the workers that we were considering, moving tasks to and from. And these are the kind of tasks that were on the table. Health promotion tasks, distributing and administering medications, and managing and treating actual kind of symptoms and conditions. The guidelines came about, I think Dominique has laid a little bit of the context for the debates around TBAs and LHWs, CHWs, community health workers in general. And where these guidelines really come to play is in the kind of what they frame as the unanswered questions. So a question that has an answer, according to the people who develop the guidelines, is, you know, for example, can auxiliary nurse midwife do breastfeeding counseling? Well, yes. There was kind of consensus that they didn't need to research that question. There's also consensus that lay health workers shouldn't be administering magnesium sulfate and doing, you know, kind of a range of other quite complicated clinical tasks. So they decided that was off the table. But they did identify a wide range of cadres and tasks for which there wasn't consensus and for which they wanted to develop an evidence base and develop a guidelines around. So the example here is midwives and neonatal resuscitation. The standard component of the guideline development process was undertaken here was searching for and assessing the quantitative evidence on safety and effectiveness of cadre X performing task Y. So we had something like 50 questions. There wasn't just one question, but there were 50 different questions. And the guideline team went looking for all the quantitative evidence that was available on safety and effectiveness for these questions. The part that I'm going to talk about is the new part. It's the new dimension, searching for and assessing the qualitative evidence on barriers and enablers to implementing task shifting programs with these different groups and kind of using these different tasks. As far as I know, this is the first time that they've used qualitative evidence in a kind of formal, official way. And built it into the kind of WHO guidelines. And it was framed largely as an implementation question. So the standard questions were, you know, safety and effectiveness and cost effectiveness. And now they were adding what they framed as implementation, which broke down largely to acceptability and feasibility. So if we do this, will people accept it, and is it feasible kind of from a health systems point of view and kind of logistical point of view. So that was the kind of task set out for qualitative work. The kinds of evidence that they commissioned and that we produced kind of reviews of for use in the guideline development, there were four systematic reviews of barriers and enablers. I worked on one and three, the lay health worker one and the midwife one. There was one on shifting between nurses and doctors. And CPADs are kind of pre-filled injection devices that you can give to lay health workers to deliver injections. So these are systematic reviews of qualitative evidence, using the same kind of systematic review methodology from Cochrane effectiveness reviews. They also did commission country case studies of large-scale national task shifting programs. So they commissioned this, and it was part of the formal evidence base, series of case studies at a kind of national programs. And there was also a thematic analysis of a random sample of email exchanges on an email list related to task shifting, the HIFA 2015 list. And they call these HIFA lumps. I think any of you know, I think it's Winnie the Pooh or something. There's an in-joke there. And finally, in the guidelines, there's a chapter that's a cross-cutting analysis of the above sets of evidence. Okay, so there's quite an interesting kind of mix of qualitative evidence that they brought. And the things that came out of this process I kind of wanted to think about what was produced in the process. Well, obviously, there's a report. There's a 100-page guideline document. There are policy briefs. There were logic models, lots of conceptual diagrams meant to impress. There's an interactive website where things move and they're animated, and you can see quite quickly by cadre and by task, you know, what the recommendation is. There is a video. This is the man who was kind of organizing the guideline process at WHO. And he has a kind of 10-minute video outlining the main recommendations. We produced methodological objects. This one was called the CERCLE approach. It's a kind of analog to the GRADE approach. It was a certainty of qualitative evidence approach, or a certainty of the findings, the kind of qualitative findings. So we had to kind of come up with an approach for that. And of course, we produced workshops. We produced relationships and networks. This is in Geneva. This is in Oslo. And the last thing that we recently have produced is a Cochrane review. And if we can get it accepted in time, we'll be. This comes to the kind of personal career development kind of aspect of this. If we can get it accepted in time, it'll be the first qualitative systematic review in the Cochrane Library, accepted as a Cochrane review, not as kind of something else that's interesting, but you know, as a Cochrane Library publication. And there's another team somewhere, I don't know where they are, but they're also working on one of these. So what I want to talk about today is what happens when social scientists bring qualitative evidence, and I keep always wanting to put this in quotes, into practices of global health guideline development, which are typically rooted in quantitative biomedical research. And you know, like I said, I was involved, I was commissioned to kind of do these syntheses, so I wasn't there as an ethnographer. I was madly kind of taking a parallel set of notes in my head. But what I'm now trying to do is to try to go back and reconstruct that experience as an anthropologist, and also have a kind of forward-going project that I'm developing that will take an anthropological perspective on it. So the kinds of questions I'm interested in, what makes these kinds of innovations possible? What made it possible for us to be sitting around the table talking about qualitative work? What are the different frictions and agendas of the people who are around the table? And what are the kind of ends they put this engagement to? What are the practices and products that emerge? How are old practices used, reused, or new ones invented? And what are the objects that are produced, and where do they circulate? What are the new frames for knowledge that are kind of mobilized? How does knowledge synthesis, qualitative social science evidence, and guidance production, how do people come to think about these differently, if at all? What is this relationship between knowing and doing? There's an already very tenuous link between evidence and policy. Does including more on context and complexity change that at all? And finally, a number of kind of methodological questions. How is the local imagined by those involved, and what knowledge practices emerge to try to address this local? What is excluded, what is included, on what terms and to what effect? And there's also, I think, like Luce spoke on Wednesday, there's this question about the innovation in methods and the regulation and kind of self-governance of these groups. So. Some context on how this kind of space emerged, this kind of opportunity. Some of this is covering, I think, ground that Dominique has covered. There have been reform movements in the WHO and elsewhere to bring more consistency and oversight to global health standard setting and policy making. And that's obviously kind of in parallel to a broader success of EBM, evidence-based healthcare, evidence-informed policy making. I think also the kind of growth and power of new concepts like systems thinking, complexity theory, health system strengthening, implementation science, operation research in the global health research and funding world has also kind of laid the ground for this. And there's been a long, slow, and kind of isolated development of this kind of thing called qualitative health research, which in my experience as an anthropologist moving into a school of public health is a very kind of un- or de-disciplined form of knowledge production that often complements clinical agendas. So it focuses on acceptability, feasibility, cultural competence, and sometimes illness experiences and meanings, but that's often the kind of extent of it. So those are the big picture kind of contextual factors. I think in relation to these guidelines, there were a few other things also that mattered. There is this policy debate that Dominique framed out a little bit about lay health workers, maternal and child health, and there's been a big kind of battle in WHO between defenders of TBAs and elsewhere. And because of HIV and TB and another of other things, there's an opening, I think, in that policy debate. There's a real ambiguity around the evidence for task shifting, and a sense that task shifting kind of is increasingly recognized as something that depends on implementation. And you have to understand implementation if you're going to have an effective program. It mattered that there was this guy, Metin Gumuzoglu, in that office at that time, you know, who was open to it, you know, and I think a lot of these things are often opened up by individuals. And finally, there are a number of key networks, collaborations, and working groups who've been waiting patiently for this kind of opportunity. I think they've been building up methods, building up kind of rhetorical claims and defenses of different epistemological positions and wanting to kind of take this opportunity. The Norwegian Knowledge Center for Health Services Research is one of them. There's a Cochrane Qualitative Methods Group, SURE Collaboration, GRADE. There's a whole cluster of these kinds of groups of people who quickly became involved in the process. So I'm going to give you a 5-minute crash course in what this looked like, how we actually tried to do synthesis of qualitative data and use it in guidelines. This is WHO's summary of what the process looks like. You identify your questions, you get the evidence, you synthesize it, you discuss, you produce the guidelines, and then there's an afterlife of the guidelines where they're disseminated and implemented and evaluated. I'll take you through a little bit more concretely kind of what those steps look like. I've told you that there's some questions that were easy to answer and some that were in this kind of orange zone, right? So we created these big tables and tried to identify what the contentious questions were. Then we had to go and search. We searched in PubMed, in CINAHL, the Nursing Index, and a couple others, but largely biomedical and kind of health sciences, public health kind of databases. And the search strategies are very complicated. This is 8 or 9 lines out of a 50-line search strategy to try to identify studies. So you search, you get 10,000 abstracts, and then you have to decide what to include, and you use your inclusion criteria. So we wanted studies that offered qualitative evidence that related to CHWs and maternal and child health, and we didn't want, you know, intensive care unit programs. We wanted community or primary care level programs. Once you decide what you're going to include, you have to assess and describe and start to extract findings. So this is part of we've created these big spreadsheets to try to describe the different studies and who was involved and who did them and what they looked at and what the designs were. We had to assess the methodological strength, and we had lots of fights over how to do that. But we ended up coming to some kind of conclusion. And the first process was extracting findings. This is a strange metaphor, but kind of, you know, extracted findings from the studies. And we put them into a conceptual framework called the SURE framework for health interventions, which gave a kind of initial ordering of the data. And we can pull out little snippets from all the different text and find a box in the framework to put it in. And finally, we had to analyze. And because this was very important work, we came up with very important terms: framework synthesis, framework thematic synthesis, cross-case analysis, indexing, charting, mapping, logic models, lots of complex terms and lots of text to justify it. When I teach methods, though, I always end up getting to the point where I have to say, and then you just analyze. Then you just analyze. There's a kind of black box for me. You know, it's not like a statistical procedure where I can actually walk you through the steps. These are the kind of things that you do, but it's not analysis. And so at the end of the day, someone had to go away and do the analysis, and they came back. Of course, the analysis produces 50 pages of text, which is not useful for a guideline, so we had to summarize and assess those findings. So we started producing tables, right? So we're distilling down the data, trying to find broad patterns, just like you would have in subheadings in an article or kind of, you know, your kind of key findings. And we also had, you'll see here, we also had to assess the certainty of particular findings and then justify how we came to that. And the way that we assess certainty, I've mentioned it before, is this circle approach. And there's not only the circle approach, but now there's the circle working group, and we are circle-lites, apparently. There's a whole kind of proliferation of terms. And this is what the guidelines look like. You probably can't see very well, but just to give you a sense, if any of you haven't seen these, this is a pretty standard first sheet, first page. Should lay health workers administer oxytocin to prevent postpartum hemorrhage using a standard syringe? And the recommendation was consider it, but only in the context of rigorous research. There's some explanation here. The second page takes you through a review of the safety and effectiveness evidence and the cost effectiveness evidence. So it asks a series of questions about that evidence. And then the third page is the new part. There's a section on acceptability and a section on feasibility. We have to say, you know, is it likely to be acceptable or uncertain? And then provide the kind of summary of the evidence for that. And of course, at the end of the day, a guideline has to make a recommendation. So this is the spectrum of possibilities. We had four possibilities. And notice, between recommend and recommend against, the two in-between positions are qualified by reference to research, so that you can do this, but only with monitoring to make sure that it's done okay. Or you can try this, but only if you do research. To kind of continue to produce the evidence base for it. Because the idea is that it probably is fine, but we actually don't have good evidence for it. So only do it if you can produce more evidence. So that's the crash course in the process. And now I just want to take you through kind of five reflections and comparisons between how this process unfolded and how it seems different to other guidelines and that I've been involved in that only look at quantitative work. We've talked a lot in the previous presentations about pragmatism. I expected a lot of orthodoxy because in qualitative health research there's a lot of kind of defensive and almost mystifying approach to method. But the methodologists on our team were quite pragmatic, and they said, decide what you think is reasonable and show your work. You know, on one hand, that seemed quite unexpected. I realized, you know, throughout the whole process, I realized that quantitative research is also shot through with pragmatism in terms of trying to manage ambiguity, uncertainty, incompleteness, context. But there are also well-established procedures for making that messiness disappear or making it less visible. And I think in qualitative work, for a variety of reasons, we don't have those techniques for making that less visible. And being reasonable and showing your work allowed for both accountability and the development of new standards and communities of practice. So showing your work and being reasonable was also about building these methods that you could then name and circulate. Showing your work is, of course, about transparency and accountability. And in framing and defending new methodological choices, this was great. I was a bit nervous coming into the process, but it was nice to be able to just kind of make stuff up and defend it. In the core work of analysis, though, showing your work had the opposite effect. And this is just an extract from some of the text. Every time you made you started to make a claim about a pattern that you saw, you had to document where that was from. So this S16, S50, it's study number 15, study number, 50. You had to say where it was from. It was almost like you could never get past the first step of just describing what was there without having to kind of always reference. And leave it, this is often talked about as an audit trail, as part of the audit trail. And it often had the effect of weighing down the analysis, forcing a reductive approach, and making abstractions harder to, not only harder to do, but harder to justify. because when you would abstract and make a broader point, how could you source it? It also had the effect of erasing the variability and diversity of the individual studies. So if you look back at, you know, these studies, it seems like they're all making the same point, but they're all very different studies. And they don't all make the same point in the same way. Distillation, I think there was this process of distilling down, but also there were quite a lot of remainders in the guidelines. So we distilled from full reviews to 5 and 2-page summaries to comments to clauses and footnotes, right? So we were really squeezing and kind of extracting the kind of core message of the findings. But also, if you look at the guideline document, there are summaries of the reviews that go on for several pages. There's a chapter on cross-cutting issues. In the appendices, there are full tables of findings, and there's links to the full reviews. So in the official, you know, guideline document, there's a lot of text, there's a lot of data that remains. And I think it's important to remember that. Why that should be, perhaps some people recognize the importance of context and detail and holism. It's probably true, but only go so far. I think we don't have techniques for making this invisible and kind of getting rid of complexity and contingency as much as we do for quantitative evidence. And I think it served a rhetorical purpose, right, in showing that the guidelines addressed context or addressed the local, and that we have all this stuff in here because we're concerned about the local. I think that was an important part. I'm just going to very quickly take you through the last two. One real difference was that we realized quickly, because the question was so broad, there was no way we could review all the evidence. You know, and most quantitative syntheses, you have to review all the evidence. You don't get to choose, you know, you don't get to say it's too many trials or you're too much work. But obviously more is not better. And what we argued was that you can't do qualitative analysis with a computer. There are only the people around this room, and we have a limited amount of time and capacity to kind of hold stuff in our head. So we have to find ways of reducing down the data set. I think that was quite a new thing to think about. Behind that decision, though, was also the fact that we only had so much time, we had so much money, and there was a palpable dread of reading more poorly done qualitative research. I mean, part of it was just like, we don't want to read anymore of these kind of 4-page, you know, I interviewed 10 people and here's my finding. And we wanted to just not avoid that. So that was a real part of the decision as well. And the last point here, this flipping the hierarchy, there was pretty broad consensus that if you're thinking about implementation and context and complexity and process, ethnographic research is at the top. And RCTs are somewhere, you know, at the bottom or on the side, and a real valuing in rhetoric of this kind of evidence. But of course, when we searched for it, we couldn't find it because we were looking in biomedical databases and health sciences ones. Even if we'd looked in social science databases, though, or read books, a lot of the ethnographic work isn't problem-focused and reductionist. It's hard to actually answer the question you're trying to answer by reading an ethnography because it doesn't organize its knowledge that way. So there was a number of kind of disconnects, despite the fact that we felt in some ways that we had flipped the hierarchy of evidence. And two closing questions, which I think recapitulate a lot of what Dominique mentioned. And these are about the future use of the guideline, not about kind of what happened, but what happens now. And I wonder about the effect of including, but then regulating or restricting the qualitative. And this is always the fear of any process of inclusion. But are you including in order to kind of police and put over here? And I think there's a complicated answer to that. I don't think it's a simple kind of process of domination. And the final one is, what is the effect of moving from a lack of clear evidence on any axis, you know, cost, safety, feasibility, in policy and practice around task shifting maternal health? What is the process of moving from that lack of evidence to having legitimated but complex and contingent evidence in the guidelines? And my hypothesis is that this will prove productive for both sides of the debate, because you can always use context to argue for your side in a way. You can always, for your particular kind of choice. So there's a kind of rhetorical value in having this certified now by Cochrane and by WHO and everything else. But I would be surprised if it answered some of these deeper kind of questions.